Welcome to the Sunshine Economy on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. Between the time we recorded our interview with Brightline President Patrick Goddard and now, two people were hit by Brightline passenger trains. One of them was killed. Florida Senators Bill Nelson and Marco Rubio called for a federal review of the train line's safety protocols. U.S. Congressman Brian Mast from North Palm Beach tweeted to Brightline, quote, "Take responsibility for the fact that your trains are killing people." He also said the trains should stop running until, quote, "massive safety flaws are resolved," end quote. And the Speaker of the Florida House, Richard Corcoran, said the state legislature would consider a bill providing state oversight of high-speed passenger trains. This likely was not the week Brightline had hoped for. The first week of bringing back passenger rail service to the downtowns of Fort Lauderdale and West Palm Beach. The trains started running with passengers just 10 days ago, hitting maximum speeds of 79 miles an hour during the scheduled 40-minute trips. When we sat down with the Brightline president, a woman had been hit and killed during a VIP train trip. She was trying to walk across a rail crossing with its gates down in Boynton Beach when the train hit her. A day after we recorded our interview, a bicyclist was hit trying to make it through downed crossing gates, also in Boynton Beach. That man died. Then on Friday night, a woman was hit by a Brightline train and hurt when she tried to get through a rail crossing in Fort Lauderdale. Three people have been hit since Brightline started carrying passengers. Two of them were killed. Two other people were hit and killed this summer as Brightline was testing its equipment preparing for its public launch. Instead of trumpeting enviable travel times between downtowns, promoting its high-end train service, and asserting itself as part of the solution to untangling traffic in South Florida, Brightline instead has had to defend its rail safety.
We need to amplify that message about safety and to encourage all members of our community to obey the bells, lights, and gates, and to never try and beat a train.
That was Brightline President Patrick Goddard on Friday at a news conference where he appeared with other regional transportation leaders. Brightline says it is not to blame for the deaths and injury. The company did announce it will expand a public safety campaign, put in more temporary signs at busy rail crossings, and use safety ambassadors at some crossings. All this happened since we sat down with Goddard last week. We spoke with him about safety at rail crossings and positive train control, a technology that will be required on trains in the United States by the end of this year to automatically avoid crashes. We also touched upon quiet zones, a point of contention for some communities, as Brightline expects to increase the number and frequency of trains. Without quiet zones, the trains are required to blow their horns before crossings. When we recorded our interview a few days ago, a Brightline train had hit and killed one woman on its inaugural day.
We are very focused, Tom, and have been over the last 5 years on education around the railroad. We've spent some time, obviously this was a tragic incident, and the victims and family members are obviously in our thoughts and our prayers. We acknowledge that nobody wants to see something like this happen in the community. But certainly we've gone to great lengths through Operation Lifesaver, which is a national nonprofit organization, and other initiatives to educate the community about rail safety, about the laws around the rail. I mean, what some people fail to appreciate is the railroads existed prior to a lot of the roads in this state, and it's the same across the country. The Florida East Coast Railroad has been there for over 100 years. And effectively it's private property, and it's a railroad. Moving objects, and that's why we've invested hundreds of millions of dollars into new signaling equipment, new arms. All of that equipment is designed to prevent people from trying to trespass. So, from our perspective, it really is an issue of communication and education throughout the community so people understand. And we've got over 50 certified volunteers within our organization who go out probably a couple times a month, if not more, and speak to the communities up and down the corridor to educate them about how to interface with railroads if they're in their communities.
The FRA is the Federal Railroad Authority. Administration. It's kind of the federal agency that governs all things on the rails. When it comes to pedestrian safety and safety upgrades, what kinds of things had been done at intersections like that were subject to this fatality?
So you've got, in this particular incident, for example, we've got, You've got the crossing gate itself. As you're approaching, you know, that gate is down about 30, 40 seconds prior to the train passing through.
This is the gate that stops vehicular traffic.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. And in addition to that, for pedestrians, we've got these, what they're called, quad gates and pedestrian gates. And again, depending on the type, and I'm not certain on this particular crossing whether it had a pedestrian gate or not, but in certain cases, we've got pedestrian gates in addition to the vehicular gates that are there and designed to prevent people from going through. But frankly, you've got audible sirens going off. Mm-hmm. You've got visual, you know, you've got lights going off. You've got the actual gate itself going down. You've got signs in advance of the crossing, signs after the crossing. You know, the way that I view it is there isn't a whole lot more, you know, that you can do to communicate that it's not a good time to try and cross the railroad.
As Brightline has begun its initial passenger service from West Palm, between West Palm Beach and Fort Lauderdale, are there any safety reviews that Brightline has undergone internally or through the Federal Railroad Administration because of these fatalities as you've approached the public service?
So let me emphasize, Tom, we are... Safety is our first priority. We've spent a lot of time, effort, and money on making sure that the railroad meets the highest standards of safety in the country. We've got some of the most expert folks involved in our team from senior leadership down, and it's a core piece of our culture. We run a safe operation. We run an extremely safe operation, and we intend to. And this is a new service for South Florida, Tom. We are very excited to introduce what is really the only intercity private passenger railroad in the country, the first of what we hope will be many such transformative projects. The feedback that we've gotten from passengers, from guests who have traveled with us over this weekend, we had several thousand people travel already from end to end on the railroad over the last couple of days. And they're walking off this thing and they're beaming like ear to ear. You know, talking about how they're never going to use Tri-Rail again, talking about they're never going to get in their car again.
You mentioned safety being number one. You've also mentioned that these railroad tracks date back to the days of Henry Flagler Lane, to open up South Florida to modern development, certainly. Yeah. The Federal Railroad Administration has found that there were 16 fatalities on the FEC tracks between Miami and Jacksonville. These are the Florida East Coast Railroad tracks that all aboard Florida doing businesses. Brightline has the rights to provide this passenger service. In 2016, 20 fatalities, which were the highest in a decade. If the highest safety precautions are being taken, what kind of helps explain this? In addition to the public interface that you talk about and the public education, is this just, you know, increased train traffic happening at moments where Florida's population continues to grow and the transportation gridlock that we continue to experience create these threats?
Yeah. So I think that any incident that happens on a railroad is any sort of death or fatality or injury that happens as a result of a railroad is just as, tragic as anything that would happen on the highway. And, you know, the frequency of incidents I can't comment on. I'm not really sure, you know, what happened on the FEC Railroad prior to our commencing operation. But it's tragic, and it's important to continue to reemphasize with the communities that we're communicating. I want all of the listeners to understand that there are laws around railroads, and there are guidelines around how to function around railroads, and they need to educate folks. I mean, you know, don't wear headphones around railroads. Don't try and beat a train. You're not going to win. The other thing that I think is important is our trains get through the crossings in seconds. And the actual, you know, from the time the crossing gate goes down to the time that it goes back up is about the same period of time as a regular traffic light cycle. Mm. It's not like a freight train that's going to be sitting there for 7 to 10 to 15, you know, 15 minutes. And this is going to, you know, this spills over into lots of other conversations, relative to to Brightline. But I think what's important to understand is that we're through there. You know, we're through there rapidly.
It's not two locomotives and four passenger cars. Yeah.
So it's a matter of seconds, and we're out of there. So
and it could be traveling at 79 miles an hour too, right?
It could. Yeah, that's our top speed, right? So our top speed is 79 miles an hour. So I think it's just important to emphasize that education. Mm. You know, just like you wouldn't encourage anyone to go and, you know, walk across I-95 or the Turnpike. It's similar in concept. It's really just an education thing, and we're doing everything we can to ensure that we get that message out.
Let me ask you about another safety precaution that the industry, the passenger rail industry in the United States, is wrestling with. And when we talk about the passenger rail service in the United States, we're talking about Amtrak mostly, talking about positive train control. This mm-hmm. is a technology that has existed for decades and decades and decades and has been spotlighted as a place that can provide much more safety. And we saw the consequences of not having positive train control in the crash recently in December, Amtrak in Washington State, the fatalities and the crash in Philadelphia back in 2015. Those are areas where investigators have said positive train control could have helped. Does Brightline have positive train control? Are you required to have that regulation in place?
Yeah, so all railroads are required to have that in place by the end of this year, and we are well underway on our implementation.
So not yet in operation, but you have the technology in place and you will be able to meet that deadline?
Yes, we will. And we've got automatic train control in place right now, which is very similar to positive train control, has much of the same features as positive train control. And in addition, you know, I cannot emphasize enough the hundreds of hours of training that our teams have had on the railroad. We've been ready to run passenger service for a lot longer than we have, and we've decided, you know, for our own reasons to make sure that we've got, you know, that we've performed the requisite amount of hours for our engineers along that railroad. We're much less, we're a much simpler operation than some of these in the Northeast. We don't have, you know, big grade changes or big curves or, you know,
it's pretty much a straight shot. Yeah, but you've got a lot of those roadway crossings, certainly a lot of canal and river crossings.
And I think that what you'll find is that, and we also have, I think we're launching right now with an experienced engineer. Everybody came to us already certified, a card-carrying engineer, and they've spent anywhere from 6 months upwards with us from a training perspective. They're supervised by, you know, there's a conductor on board, and there's also we've got a manager supervising those folks. So safety is a real priority for us, Tom, and we are extremely focused on making sure that, you know, our initial phase of operation is the safest in the nation. And in addition to that, we'll have this PTC, this positive train control, in place before the end of the year.
The federal deadline for operators like Brightline and Amtrak to have positive train control is December. That deadline has been delayed many times, and there's some argument that it could be delayed again. Would Brightline activate this PTC, positive train control, even if that December 2018 deadline is extended?
Yes, we're actively working on it. We're actively in the process of implementing it. We're already on a roll with that, and it's like once you start, you're not going to stop.
Let me ask about another safety-related issue, and that is the continuous quiet zones in Palm Beach County that have been pledged. What's the update with those?
Yeah. So we hear our residents' concerns on that particular issue, and we are actively working with all of the municipalities up and down the corridor to get them implemented as soon as possible. There's a huge priority, huge emphasis on this internally. We appreciate everyone's concern about it. We hear everyone. We don't want to appear tone deaf on the issue. It's a matter of getting it, the municipalities have a role, we have a role. And you know what folks tend to forget is they didn't exist, or they haven't existed for a long time. There have not been quiet zones for a very long time. And were it not for, you know, our initiative with these municipalities, there wouldn't be one.
The freight lines will be subject to them as well,
That's
the FEC
right.
freight lines.
That's right.
A quiet zone essentially ends the requirement that trains need to sound their horn twice, a long blow and then a short blow for anywhere from 15 to 20 seconds. And that's what people would like to see. What upgrades are necessary in order to put those quiet zones in place.
It's some physical modifications to the gates and some software updates to the signal software.
So why not do that during the other upgrades that were necessary to launch the service?
Sequentially, my understanding is this was the most effective way to get it done.
And it's not, Brightline pays for it initially, but you get reimbursed the money for these upgrades from the Palm Beach Transportation Agency.
Yes, I can't speak to exactly the mechanics of that, but there is some public-private partnership.
A West Palm Beach official, I think it was in December, put a Facebook posting up saying that they don't expect these quiet zones to be in place for another 4 to 6 months. Does that timeline sound appropriate to you?
I think it's shorter than that.
How short?
Again, don't know exactly. I know they've started on them and they're working through it. I mean, there is an army of folks that has been deployed to get this done. We hear the residents, we're focused on it, and we've got an army of folks deployed to get it executed as soon as is possible.
Brightline President Patrick Goddard. Each of the three South Florida counties that will have Brightline service has their own approach to quiet zones. Some zones already exist in Miami-Dade County. Broward County is taking a county-wide approach, while individual Palm Beach communities with Brightline tracks are handling it. While Brightline initially pays for the work necessary, it is reimbursed by county transportation agencies. Our interview with the Brightline boss continues, and still to come, the cost to ride the rails.
We're very happy to be able to offer these introductory fares. It's not going to get better than that, I can say that. This is as good as it's going to get.
Welcome back to the Sunshine Economy on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. It has been a little over a week since Brightline launched the first part of its first phase of its $1 billion-plus high-speed passenger rail service. The first week was dimmed by three separate crashes at rail crossings. Two of them were fatal. A third injured a woman. Brightline says the crashes happened as people were trying to get through the crossing gates as trains approached. Now, the trains mark the return of passenger rail service between the downtowns of West Palm Beach, Fort Lauderdale, and eventually Miami. Brightline is a private company owned by the company that owns the railroad tracks it runs along, Florida East Coast Railway. Trains are not rolling into Miami yet. For now, the service runs 11 round trips between West Palm and Fort Lauderdale each weekday. Launching that service this month came after months of delays. In March, when we spoke with Dave Howard, who was the Brightline CEO at the time, he told us trains would start rolling before the end of the summer.
We're obviously gearing up for our sort of a soft launch of our introductory service, starting between West Palm Beach and Fort Lauderdale in July, and then incorporating the Miami station in August. And we'll be ramping up that towards the full grand opening, full service in September.
Now, that didn't happen. Construction continues on the Miami train station, and service just began rolling between Fort Lauderdale and West Palm Beach, 6 months behind the timeline we heard about last spring. So we asked about the delay and the initial ticket prices with Patrick Goddard, president of Brightline.
When you're doing something of this scale and importance, you can't, can't rush it, B, it's a big project. It's a big project with lots of moving parts. So I think it's good to have an aggressive schedule, and we've met lots of deadlines. We've, in a short sort of 3 years, we've delivered two stations and five train sets. I mean, it's pretty impressive. I mean, this is going to transform the way people travel around South Florida. And, whether it's slightly behind schedule or not, I honestly, I don't think it's
the last thing a train operator wants to do is run anything behind schedule when schedules are published.
Once we're operating, for sure.
Have you identified, though, what led to those delays, and have you addressed them?
I can't speak to what was communicated back, 6 months ago, or what the circumstances were around that. What's important now is that we're open and operating, and South Floridians need to get out and try this service. We're out there with introductory fares of $10, mm-hmm. $15, and we think that they're going to, I cannot emphasize enough how happy folks were getting off these trains on the weekend.
Let's talk a little bit about the fare structure. $10 for a regular
for smart,
seat.
For what we call smart service.
It's a 19-inch seat, right?
Yeah. And then
that's 15, a one-way fare.
Correct.
Right.
And then $15 for Select, which is a
21 inches.
Another couple of inches of pitch.
Yep.
It's a 2-1 configuration in the coach, so you've got more space, generally speaking, to circulate. You've got a dedicated train attendant. We're including food and beverage, access to a VIP lounge. So it's a we're finding all our Select coaches full since we've launched. So, you know.
Even during the week.
Mean, they're all, I'm not going to say every single train, but we're close.
And how many trains are you running?
Everyone's
now
going for it. So we're running 11 round trips on the during the week and 10 on the weekends.
Okay.
And that will increase as we get to understand what the South Florida community is looking for. But we really want to emphasize that people try this service. It really is unique, and it's something that until you actually get on it, you don't really understand it. We're not a train traveling community, really. There's not a lot of people who travel by train in this community, so this will be a very new experience for a lot of people.
You've called this an experience more than transportation, right?
That's
part of that kind of luxury value, that brand that Brightline is trying to build.
We're in many ways it's like a lifestyle brand. We're at the intersection of hospitality and transportation.
Which is your background, is
that's
hospitality.
Right.
You were in hotel management for a number of years
before
you came into transportation.
That's right. So for me, it's very similar to, I was in the boutique hotel space or the lifestyle hotel space. And this is very much like bringing that dimension to transportation. And we've spent a lot of time as we developed the guest experience thinking about everything from, pre-arrival, the technology you're going to use to book your ticket, to arriving at the station and the convenience of parking or getting out of your car, walking in, getting your station, getting your ticket, walking through the turnstiles, enjoying a luxurious departure lounge with food and beverage and just background music, and it smells good and it looks good and great uniforms, and it's a really, really pleasant experience before you board the train. And then on board, again, we've really tried to think of our guests. We really try to think about what their needs are going to be and what, both from a functionality perspective and from a design. Everybody enjoys nice interior design. Everybody enjoys a nice aesthetic, and I think they're going to find that on board our trains.
Your predecessor, Dave Howard, also came from the world of hospitality and entertainment. He helped run the New York Mets and Madison Square Gardens for a number of years. Your appointment as the head of Brightline coincided with the launch of the inaugural service. Why the leadership change at that important of a time in the operation of Brightline?
I think Dave did an incredible job of helping us transform culturally from a development company. I mean, we've been a development company for, 6 or 7 years, right, to an operating company. And he still remains involved, and I'm able to pick the phone up, and I know he's riding our trains as we speak. And he was a great contributor to the experience that we've created there.
He's still involved in Brightline?
Yeah, advising, yes.
Still advising, as an outside advisor,
yes.
For instance? Okay. Let me ask about the fares. You have described the $10 and the $15 fare structure as an introductory fare structure.
Yeah.
How long is that going to last?
I don't know that I know that yet. I don't think we know yet. I think that ultimately we're going to have some sort of dynamic pricing based on demand, but I don't know what that looks
like. So means rush hour could be more than middle of the day kind of thing.
It's conceivable, entirely conceivable. I mean, I think what we want to do is we want to, we imagine that there's going to be some peak time riders, so there'll be some level of dynamic pricing, but I don't think price is going to be an issue based on what we've experienced so far.
What do you mean by price not being an issue?
I just think that the price value for what they're getting. I mean, at $10, it's an absolute bargain. I feel comfortable that based on the data and the research that we've done over the last several years, we're well below what we think the tolerance could be.
Hmm. Give us a sense of what do you think that is.
Again, can't speak to that yet. I think that, I don't want to hamstring us into any sort of pricing parameters. I think that
you'd be negotiating against yourself here, right?
Right.
Yeah.
I think right now we're very happy to be able to offer these introductory fares. We want to be able. It's not going to get better than that. I can say that.
You're not going to have a fair sale,
right? So okay. this is as good as it's going to get. We think that people will appreciate the value that they're going to get.
When you're looking at that introductory fare structure, what are you looking at in terms of how long that could last, or as you look at new dynamic pricing or new pricing models, what could trigger price changes?
I think, Tom, our view is right now we're introducing fares so people can get out of gridlock and, you know, have a convenient, predictable travel experience from point to point. So whereas when you get on 95, if it rains or there's a fender bender, you really actually don't know what time you're going to arrive. You're going to have the, you're going to know that, I mean, our travel time between West Palm Beach and Fort Lauderdale is about 35 minutes. You know, you can't do that at rush hour. It's impossible. So we just think that at introductory fares of $10 to make that trip, there's incredible value in that. There's incredible value in, and not only that, but, you know, not only are you out of gridlock, but you've left your car behind. You're able to be productive. I mean, when you sit in our leather seats and you set your laptop up and you get yourself a cup of coffee served and you sit down, you can actually be productive for that 35-minute period. You know, someone got off the train on Monday morning on their way to work and said and told me they had barely gotten their laptop out and drunk their coffee, and the Fort Lauderdale station was already coming into vision. So, I mean, it's just a whole other way to operate. And we just think that you look at all of the conveniences that we have today. You know, you go to your phone for your, you know, your Uber app or your Starbucks app or your, you know, whatever that is. We want people to make Brightline a part of their everyday life. We know that, you know, I can see people getting up in the morning and getting their cup of coffee and going to the gym and then getting in an Uber and going to Brightline and pulling up their app and getting their ticket and jumping on board and getting to work. I mean, we believe it will become a part of the everyday modern conveniences that South Floridians are going to enjoy.
Give me a sense of the socioeconomic profile that you've put together for a Brightline commuter. You talk about this luxury train service, $10 each way, $20 round trip between West Palm. That's $100 a week, for instance, if somebody's doing that 5 days a week.
Yeah. So again, I still think it's a great value when you look at tolls and gas and your car and all that. But besides that, think about our station locations. We're going city to city. There are other transportation modalities that are available out there that are too far west, that aren't convenient, that have you waiting outside in the heat or the rain. This is a whole other experience. So we're going to be talking to commuters, like individuals who actually have to get to work every morning and get back every evening. Those are obviously a group of targets for us. We think that there are lots of people who have to make occasional trips, whether they're attorneys who've got to go and do court, you know, in Broward or in West Palm or in Miami. We're looking at, or you're a salesperson who's got to get up to Fort Lauderdale and visit with some clients. By the way, we'll have a rental car. Avis is our rental car partner. We'll have an Avis office at each station. So you could conceivably get to a station, rent a car, do your sales calls, get back to the station and get home. That's really who we're talking to. And then the millions of tourists that come to South Florida who, you know, obviously we're ultimately looking to go to Orlando, and a lot of those folks, you know, the thought of renting a car and driving down the turnpike to get to Miami is scary. So to be able to, you know, have the peace of mind that you can get on this comfortable upscale experience that's reliable, that's convenient, that's easy to get to, that's safe, we think it's going to be very appealing to a lot of people.
Brightline President Patrick Goddard. Our interview with him continues. Still to come, when will the trains roll south into Miami?
Actually, a lot of the track work is done. It's really signaling work now and testing. So we're a couple of months away.
This is the Sunshine Economy on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. High-speed passenger trains were expected to be rolling already from West Palm Beach all the way down to Miami and back. But the last half of that journey has yet to open. After delays, Brightline opened its West Palm to Fort Lauderdale service 10 days ago. Trains have been involved in three separate crashes since then, killing two pedestrians and injuring one. Brightline says it is not to blame for the crashes. Even as the investigations continue and critics push for state oversight of rail safety, Brightline continues moving forward toward bringing its trains into downtown Miami and eventually north into Orlando. Now, Miami represents its largest market and its largest real estate development deal that goes along with the train service. The Miami Central train station stretches across six blocks and it will eventually include 800 apartments and 150,000 square feet of office space with four transportation systems converging: Brightline, Tri-Rail, Metrorail, and Metromover. Back to our interview with Brightline President Patrick Goddard.
It's progressing very nicely. Finishes are going in now. We're probably a couple of months away at most, and we're pushing towards it every day. So we're excited about that, and we'll keep everybody up to date as we get closer.
Possibly a couple of months before the train comes in to Miami Central.
Yeah.
And the delay challenges that you encountered in getting the service from Fort Lauderdale to West Palm, do those same kinds of challenges exist in Dade County?
It's Rome wasn't built in a day, Tom. You know, this is a transformative venture for South Florida. This is going to transform how people travel around this state. So it's progressing really, really well. It's beautiful. People are going to be blown away. And that entire neighborhood is going to change. You know, we're in the Overtown neighborhood, as you know, and we've done a lot of work there. Our offices, our headquarters are now based in Overtown. It's going to transform that whole neighborhood. People are waiting for us to get open there. They're all sitting on their land waiting to build.
So that's the real estate play here. Yeah. But what about the tracks themselves in Dade County? How much more work needs to happen
Actually, a lot of the track work is done. It's really signaling work now and testing. So we're a couple of months away.
So will Dade County begin seeing the Brightline trains?
We've already been down to the Miami station with the trains, but we're going to get out of the way and let everybody get done there, and then we'll resume. We'll get some testing underway there, but we'll communicate that via public advisories once we get there.
So it sounds like maybe the end of the first quarter that could be launched.
Could be sooner than that, but next couple of months.
What's going to determine that?
It's really just a matter of getting the work done, right? Yeah. So we're close. We're close. We're making great progress.
And then the green light was given recently to expand north of Palm Beach County into the Treasure Coast and eventually on into Orlando.
Yeah.
How's that second phase timeline looking?
Yeah. So we're finalizing permits for that phase. We're working on financing for that phase. There's several financing processes underway. I think we're all expecting somewhere in this in before the end of the first quarter that we're going to begin construction.
And that kind of construction timeline is about
30 month. I mean, early estimates are about a 30 month build.
So almost 3 years then before you're able to pull a train into Orlando.
The actual shell of our station exists already inside the new South Terminal at Orlando International Airport. That project is going to bring, we're going to add train sets, longer train sets.
More cars.
So we'll have a capacity of about 500 passengers on those versus 240 or so on our current configuration.
So would that mean, what, six or seven passenger cars?
I think
cars
it's seven cars
train?
And then a retail car, which would have basically be a grab and go on the train.
Okay.
So there'd be a food and beverage service on the train.
We used to call those bar cars, but they don't call them bar cars in the 21st century.
We can call
anymore.
Them bar cars for you,
Tom. No, you don't need to do that.
We're very excited about that. I mean, by the time we go to Orlando, we'll have PTC fully implemented.
The positive train control we spoke about
the
earlier.
Positive train control will be fully implemented. Yep. We'll have the larger train sets that'll be able to ferry people back and forth. We're looking at hourly service there as well, which will be a game changer. I mean, there's about 365 million trips between Central Florida and South Florida on an annual basis.
You've encountered a lot of resistance in the Treasure Coast to Brightline, folks that have been worried about safety precautions, folks that have been worried about quiet zones or the lack thereof, as well as communities that have said, you're going to come through our community, but you're not going to stop. You're going to take all these millions of passengers, you hope, and just bring them right through without stopping.
Yeah. So we hear the concerns of the Treasure Coast residents, and we continue to meet with them about the project. the FEC Railway has been in operation for a long time in that area, and we're going to bring a lot of improvements to the infrastructure through there. I mean, the infrastructure already exists. There are already trains running through those communities. We are going to enhance the safety of that infrastructure going through those neighborhoods. We're working with the FRA and the Florida Department of Transportation to ensure that, again, we are operating at the highest levels of safety in the nation.
There is a new spur that's going to make that big curve to the west, though, to go out to Orlando once you get north of the Treasure Coast, right?
Yeah. I mean, again, they're finalizing some of that planning right now, so I can't tell you that any of that is buttoned up as I sit here today. But certainly there will be some new infrastructure that's going to take us from Cocoa into the airport.
Any plans eventually, even in draft form, to make stops in that area?
Listen, I think that right now we're very focused on, like, this project was a Miami to Orlando project. We're today launching West Palm Beach to Fort Lauderdale, which is like, you know, a fraction of a fraction. We're going to get down to Miami soon, which is a fraction. We'll get to Orlando. I think we've got to progressively understand what the market wants. I think, you know, there's anything is possible, but we're laser focused on getting these three cities connected right now.
Brightline President Patrick Goddard. Still to come as our interview continues, the finances to keep the trains running on time.
There really isn't anything like it, and we think that people will be happy to, you know, part with $10 or more to travel, you know, one segment.
Welcome back to the Sunshine Economy on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening this week. Brightline is a $3 billion project as envisioned, a high-speed passenger train service running from downtown Miami to Orlando International Airport with stops in the downtowns of Fort Lauderdale and West Palm Beach. That's the idea. It is a privately run and privately financed effort, though it relies on a type of financing that allows it to borrow money, and its lenders are not taxed on the interest they receive. Normally, when a private company issues bonds, the investors in those bonds would have to pay federal tax on their interest. Not so for the type of bonds Brightline has sold to help pay for its South Florida service. It issued $600 million of IOUs in December and found plenty of investors willing to buy the bonds, even though one credit rating agency gave them a non-investment grade rating. That's considered a lower quality investment with higher risks. The bonds will be paid back through Brightline's revenues. They're backed by the company's assets, stuff like the train engines, the train cars, and the train stations. Fitch Ratings says its assessment was based on, quote, the uncertainty surrounding demand for high-speed passenger rail and willingness of passengers to pay Brightline's fares. Now, we don't know much about Brightline's financial projections. As a private company, it is not required to release its numbers. But the Fitch Ratings report on its $600 million of bonds includes several details of what to expect. The forecasts come from infrastructure consulting firm Lewis Berger, which was hired by the train company to produce ridership and revenue estimates. For instance, the report predicts Brightline will carry about 1 million passengers this year, but that will triple by 2020. By then, the trains should be running from Miami to West Palm Beach, but not all the way to the Orlando airport yet. By 2020, the study predicts Orlando will be bringing in $143 million in revenue, three-quarters of that from train fares, most of the rest of the money expected to come from selling food, drinks, and parking at its stations. Now, by comparison, Tri-Rail carried about 4 million passengers in 2016, bringing in $13 million in revenue, just a fraction of what it cost to run Tri-Rail. Remember, though, Tri-Rail runs a much different route than Brightline, and its ticket prices are a lot lower. Tri-Rail also gets a lot of public money to operate, whereas Brightline does not. In March, we spoke with the executive director of Brightline's parent company, Florida East Coast Industries. Back then, the service was expected to start last summer, and Mike Reiniger had this financial forecast.
We expect that we will be break-even or profitable in 2018.
Brightline's current president, Patrick Goddard, now is not so confident as the service began rolling just 10 days ago.
So obviously that's changed, so projections are now going to need to be revised, and that's underway.
So possibly not being able to break even this year.
I don't, not in a position to talk about our projections.
How about ridership projections? I think that in the revenue bonds that were recently issued by the Florida Development Finance Corporation on behalf of Brightline, the credit rating agency Fitch Ratings came in and looked at the bonds, of course, and gave a non-investment grade for investors. But it was expecting, what, a little over a million riders this year?
So I can't remember exactly what was in that study. What I can tell you is we've had an incredible response to this initial phase of launch, and I'm highly encouraged by that. We've had such an incredible response. We had like capacity issues on the first few trains. So, I'm highly encouraged by that. I think that it's too early to tell. And we're not in a position to get into our current projections. But we're highly encouraged about the direction we're headed.
Is it roughly about a million passengers you expect this year?
I think that was the number that was in that study.
Right.
I don't think that was an unrealistic projection for a full year of operation.
And it looked to be double that by 2019 in 1 year's time.
I think that we're going to do extremely well in this market. I think that people are waiting for this product. I think that they need it. And based on 4 or 5 days of operation, it looks like they are responding extremely positively.
Fitch also talked about uncertainty over what it called willingness to pay for luxury service when it gave the bonds a non-investment grade rating. Clearly, as the executive, you probably don't share that concern that the trading has.
No, and again, this is why I really want people to experience this, because when you compare it to getting into your car and you compare it to sitting in traffic and you get on board and you experience what we're offering here, there's nothing like it. There really isn't anything like it, and we think that people will be happy to, part with $10 or more to travel, one segment.
As you look at the business model, what portion of revenue do you see coming from fares versus from other services such as food and beverage or parking?
So Tom, without getting into projections again, I can tell you that we've got all kinds of other opportunities as we try and deliver a holistic experience to folks as they arrive. So, we are managing parking garages, mm-hmm. We've got food and beverage services, we've got food and beverage services in the station on board. There are a number of different components, but again, can't really get into.
I know as a private
what
company,
the composition is.
Sure, you're not required to share any of that information as a private company, so that's why we're relying on the Fitch Ratings report, which looks and makes some financial projections from a financial professional. It also described its expectations of about 10% of Brightline riders to be commuters, with the main travelers being business travelers and tourists.
Yeah, I mean, again, we're when you're doing a study like this, and we've spent a lot of time out there talking to the market, obviously, to and to assist folks in coming to some of these conclusions. It's very difficult to, this is brand new for South Florida.
It's brand new for the United States, for that matter.
There's nothing to compare to, right? So, we're at a point now where I was going to say where the rubber meets the road, but it's really where steel meets steel, right? I have to change my analogies. But this is, the studies and the reports and the projections are great. And I think that...
Do they ring true to you as you
look
at them?
I think that there's many aspects of it that are indicative of the type of success that we're going to have. But what I can say is we've gotten really positive indications so far, and we're extremely optimistic about where we're headed.
The financial projections that Brightline has internally and the financial projections that are included in the credit rating report from Fitch Ratings regarding the $600 million of revenue bonds, do they echo one another? Are they close to what the company itself is expecting?
Yes, I think that there's a lot of validity to what's in there.
Our interview with Brightline President Patrick Goddard continues. Still to come, the company's ambitions beyond South Florida.
This is proof of concept, and I think that we'll get south to Miami, we'll get up to Orlando, but there's already interest around the country.
Welcome back to the Sunshine Economy. I'm Tom Hudson. Today, it's Brightline, safety, service, and selling passenger rail to South Floridians. We're featuring our interview with Brightline President Patrick Goddard. The passenger train service just began operating the first part of its first phase of service, running between Fort Lauderdale and West Palm Beach. Goddard says trains should be rolling into downtown Miami in a couple of months. Orlando is due to be added in 2021. But Brightline's business may not end there.
What we've done in South Florida is we've modernized infrastructure and created something that's transformative for the state. And we're in our early days here. I mean, this is the beginning of what we're doing here. It's proof of concept, right? So this is proof of concept. And I think that, you know, we'll get south to Miami, we'll get up to Orlando, but there's already interest around the country in other corridors that are too far to drive, too short to fly for something like this.
In Florida, just to focus first of all on the rest of the state, I believe that Brightline has secured the rights to run passenger service on FEC tracks up to Jacksonville. Is that a place that Brightline could look at for expansion?
I think conceivably, yes.
What are the ingredients that Brightline would look for?
Too short to fly, too far to drive. And, you know, where there's existing corridors or where we can get help.
Existing corridors meaning there's rail that already exists.
Yeah. I mean, that's obviously the shorter putt, right? you know, if it's not there, it's, you know, a little bit more difficult.
That proof of concept that the parent company, the owners, Fortress Investment Group, is going to look at is going to be a bottom line number, a P&L, a profit and loss, ultimately. What kind of time frame do they have?
Again, not at liberty to get into the projections and the time frame. The proof of concept is not only a financial sort of analysis. We're solving an infrastructure problem, and have we effectively done so? And I believe we're going to a large extent.
What does success look like in solving that problem?
I think the short term for us is getting people to experience it and getting people to ride on the train. And we feel as we continue to solve people's daily problems in their daily lives, the popularity is going to grow. We think it's going to be exponential.
Brightline CEO Patrick Goddard. You can follow us on Twitter. Look for our handle at WLRN. Also, look for a podcast of this program and all our programs. You can find those by searching Sunshine Economy on iTunes. Pilar Ribe is our technical director. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening.